Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Transcription for this podcast is brought to you by HarperTranscriptions.com. If you have any transcription needs, please head on over to our website. And if you mention this podcast, They Had to Go Out, your first transcription will be for free. Stay salty, my friends.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us today. Thanks for listening to us. Thanks for downloading all the episodes, following us on social media, and getting the word out. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, everybody, welcome. If it's your first time here, we're glad you found us. We know you're going to enjoy what you're listening to.
It's a bosun mate.
Of course.
Yeah.
And after you listen and you love what you heard, go back and listen to some other episodes. Follow us on Instagram. Follow us on on the Apple Podcast. Give us a review. 5 stars, of course. That's the only kind of review we're really looking for. And if there's something you want to hear, or you know somebody who you think would be good, reach out to us. And with that, another thing I want to mention: a friend of the show asked us to mention this, and we're more than happy to. It's an event that's the 11th of July. In a place called Newfound Lake, New Hampshire, which I've looked up online. It looks like an awesome spot. It's called Swim with a Mission. So y'all go out there and check out swimwithamission.org. They're a veterans support group. To date, they've raised about $2.3 million for some different veteran groups. This particular competition, they usually get about 6,000 to 8,000 people to come out and watch it.
To watch us too.
Maybe to watch us.
I mean, if you ever return phone calls.
Hopefully, the friend of the show is listening and he hears.
Yeah, friend of the show, just know your point of contact over there is going to let you down.
Hopefully,
here's
the guilt in my voice. with that, the swim competition. This has been a Navy SEAL heavy event in the past. What they're looking to do is get some Coast Guard in it. Maybe we can show up the Navy SEALs, especially if there's any ASTs out there listening.
Because it couldn't be a bosun mate. You notice he said that too. Yeah, that's
I
why
feel I like swimming's their job.
It is.
I'll drive the safety boat. They can swim.
But it's more like sheer determination
right.
of a bosun mate to just win.
Right. We'll finish. I think they're faster.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, we would finish.
We would definitely finish. But with that being said, go check out swimwithamission.org. It is a great organization. I've had a chance to meet some of the guys. They've helped some retired and current Navy SEALs. They do a lot with getting service dogs for these guys as well. So again, go check it out, swimwithamission.org, and we'll be plugging out some more going forward.
Yeah, and you got to mention too that there's now a pretty strong Coast Guard connection with some heads of that organization.
Absolutely.
So, you know, expect it to start benefiting some Coast Guard personnel too at some point. So, yeah, for sure, swimwithamission.org, right?
Yep, swimwithamission.org. And
right.
Like I said, go check it out. And if you're free that weekend in July, come enter the race.
Yep.
We might even get Mike up there since he's
close.
Yeah. But hey, without further ado, we won't keep the guy on the line too long without bringing him in. We have a Coast Guard Medal recipient today, and for those of you who don't know, we've had a couple on the show, pretty rare. Back in the day, pre-Coast Guard Medal times, it was gold and silver life-saving medals were issued to active duty service members. At some point, they transitioned to where it became active duty get Coast Guard medals, civilians, and non-Coast Guard responders get the gold and silver life-saving. So, huge honor to have this guy on. I cannot wait to hear the story of, hopefully he tells it, right, of how he earned this. I'm assuming, right? Well, it's got to be up there somewhere.
You just set him up, Phil. He's going to be like, it's not even about
right?
story.
Yeah, right? It's about something else. Yeah. We know how that goes, too, because sometimes you get awarded for the things that you're like, man, I don't even know that happened.
Really?
But I read the citation for this one. Truly an epic tale. Can't wait to have him on. Who we've got on the line? Mr. Mike Underwood, born and raised in San Diego, California, joined the Coast Guard back in 1985 with recruit company Lima 121. First assignment, he was lucky enough to pre-com the Coast Guard cutter Spencer, the later home ported in Boston. He was in the deck department there. Somehow scored a reprieve and got to Cape Cod Canal Station. Became a 41 coxswain as a non-rate, one of the few. Struck BM while he was there. Got some bad advice, told him to go to college, so he just got out and went into the reserves, did end up going to college. While in the reserves, did a tour of summer stock at Harbor Beach, which I know is a very popular reserve program. Haven't seen a few people come through the Great Lakes. Wouldn't let him come back in as a BM, forced him to go non-rate, but ended up at Station Point Judith, did a full tour there. Working out of Sardet Block Island. That's where he earned the Coast Guard Medal. Went from there to Station Chatham. We all know the home of Bernie Weber and such lore. And then to the Coast Guard Cutter Block Island, a 110 as the Ops Petty Officer. Then the Coast Guard Cutter Shinnecock, Coast Guard Cutter Chinook out of New London was the Executive Petty Officer, the number two job there. Then Station Castle Hill, where he rounded out 23 years of service and retired in 2009. Heck of a career.
That's a career. And D1 Mafia the whole time.
D1 Mafia and definitely a boat guy. You know what
right.
I mean? So already, I we're friends.
Yep.
Yep. But with that, I'll let Bill go ahead and ask the question.
Yeah, Mike, the question. Welcome, first of all. Glad to have you on the show. And what is your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Thank you. Thanks for having me. So I'll start it out with, "Arg, it was a dark and stormy night."
Nice. Is it Talk Like a Pirate Month, by the way?
Well,
yeah,
I'm just kidding. Verbose myth, it's always Talk Like a Pirate Month, right?
Yeah, it just felt appropriate, you know? When I was at Point Judith, it was a dark and stormy night eventually, but it started out on a Friday afternoon. It was, I'd just come on duty and read the weather reports, as a good bosun mate does, and checked the weather, and we started our Friday field days.
And tell us a little bit about Station Point Judith, Mike. What, where's it located, and what kind of holes and stuff do you guys have? How many people?
So when I was there, it's in Point Judith, Rhode Island, and it's got fantastic views of the ocean and Block Island, and, you know, you're literally on a little point, and you get epic sunrises and sunsets, but
great surf, as I recall, too.
Yeah, a lot of guys surf there. It's a little rough right in front of the station, but you know, about 500 yards up, it was a fantastic spot where they would all line up in the surf. But anyway, it was a Friday field day. We were all cleaning, and we got a call for a tugboat on fire in the Sound coming across. And we all ran down. I had the duty coxswain that day. We jumped in the GV and had to drive 2 miles down to the boathouse. For those that don't know, it's detached from the station.
That's a thing, right? I mean, that's pretty prevalent up in that area.
The
Great White North, as I always call it. Yeah,
you're heading to the Great White North.
I know, man. Let's not go there.
So we get down to the boat, and it's like, wow, it's pretty nasty out, and we jumped on the 41 and we head out out the channel, and we went out into the they call it the apex. It's like a giant break wall, and we go flying out, and I turn out the west gap, and all of a sudden it was green water on the windshield, and I was like, yeah, we're in the wrong boat. And I looked back, and everyone was just like white knuckles, and no one would let go of anything. So I just kind of had to sit there and time it before I could even turn around to go back in. So we took a good half a dozen, you know, green water up to the windshield on the 41.
And how big is that inlet when you guys are coming through?
The west gap is probably a football field wide, so it's plenty wide enough.
Yeah.
But, you know, when it's whipping, it's going.
What would you estimate the seas at, Mike?
At that point, they were probably 20, and they were short.
Solid day, yeah.
Yeah. So what had happened was this winter storm. It was, I don't want to get too technical, but it was basically a bombogenesis, so to speak, or a perfect storm. A couple of fronts had converged and basically ripped up Long Island Sound, and we're basically pushing everything up the sound. And so we turned around, and we finally got back in, and they were like, what do you mean you're coming back for another boat? I'm like, yeah, we're in the wrong boat. So what? The National Weather Service had posted an update like a half hour before we went out, and it was like, the potential for severe weather may exist. And you know how it was. I don't know if you know how it was back in that day. It was, you know, the computers were a lot slower and message traffic was slower and everything else.
Yeah, now everybody's got it on their cell phone screen, right? Like, just,
well, yeah. But Coast Guard systems are still exactly the same as they probably were back
then. Probably
that
the
day.
Exact same,
but yes,
infrastructure.
We all have our own cell phones, yeah.
So we jumped on the 44, and it was like, all right, let's go. And this was like 45 minutes later, or maybe less, I don't remember, but we start cruising out as fast as we can, and it was like, wow, this is worse. So we're cruising, and you know, it's really rolling now, and we're trying to get, you know, radio comms and figure out where this guy's at. And a fishing boat, it was a something green something, I don't remember, he was en route too, and wasn't sure he was going to be able to do anything. He was basically running to get back into the harbor because it was so nasty out. But this tugboat was on fire this whole time, and by the time we got there, these guys were huddled on the bow, and you know, it's freaky when you see paint bubbling and smoking on the outside of a ship. And it was like, all right, we got to get these guys off of this thing. So we were trying to get up close to them, and it, you know, at this point it's probably 30 foot. So I kind of said, all right, we got to figure this out. So these guys weren't waiting. They were climbing over the bow skirt, the rope bow skirt, and they're basically hanging on the outside of the tugboat at this point. And I said, all right, we got to get them because they're not waiting any longer. So I pulled up alongside the port side, thinking I could just kind of like roll up on them. And it was, you know, the seas were so bad, it just pushed me. We just slammed right into the sides of each other. One guy fell inside the hand railings on the bow of the 44. So we grabbed him and backed off because it was like the tugboat in the swells had started to roll. And I don't know if we caught like one of their railings or something, but it was like it was starting to roll on top. And the bow of the 41, you know, the guys on the bow were standing in water because it had started to push us underwater. So I was like, yeah, that's not going to work. Back up. So I backed up, and I was like in a crossing T position. And all of a sudden, they all jumped. It was like, what? So thankfully, you know, the rescue swimmer was dressed, and back then they wore neoprene. They didn't wear the dry suits that we have today. And the kid was ready, and he saw that, and I looked back, and he was already had his hands on the railings, like, just waiting for go. And I said, go. And now these guys are in the water already, and in that kind of weather, you can imagine people start to dissipate and spread apart. He brought all of his line out, and I still don't know how he did it to this day, and I don't think he does either. He swam around all five of them, grabbed his own life ring, and made it like a lasso loop.
Nice.
Cowboy stuff.
Yeah, right.
Like I said, I don't know how he did it, and I don't think he knows how he did it. I don't think how anybody knows how he did it, but it was just fate and luck, and it was like a big, like you said, a cowboy ring. And, man, it was everyone was pulling with all their might to get them in, and they got them all in. And, oh, I remember now why they jumped, because while we were in a crossing tee trying to figure out a different approach, the pilot house windows blew out. It was like an explosion.
Yeah,
it was,
yeah.
That'll do it. Yeah. Time to egress.
I'm jumping at that point too.
Time to go. So that's why they all jumped. But we got them all on board, and the rescue swimmer, you know, only being in like a wetsuit at the time, was basically hypothermic, and we had to get him back.
What are the crew members from the tug, and had they had time to put on survival suits, or are they just in street clothes?
No, it was kind of a mix of street clothes and survival suits, but I think there was only one or two survival suits because basically the whole inside of the tug was on fire.
Right.
So they and I guess they found it because the engineer was doing his duty round, and he opened the door and was like, "Yep, wall of flames," and you know, shut the thing, and then it just kept getting worse.
Right.
But we beat feet back to the dock, and you know, this is in February, and it's cold. February, January, and it's cold, and you know, our survival gear wasn't what it is today. But you know, we got back, got the swimmer and the other people to the hospital, and got them checked out. And you know, in the background, the group, well, the sector now, but the group was trying to come up. They were all concerned about, you know, what's going on with this thing now. So, and in the meantime, they were trying to figure out how to handle this or what's going on.
Because the burning boat's still in the harbor, right?
Well, it's offshore.
It's offshore, okay.
Yeah, it's between Point Judith and Block Island.
Okay.
You know, and this thing's got, you know, a tow cable out, and, you know, it's just burning up with, you know, a few hundred millions of gallons of diesel on the barge.
Right.
And
oh, I didn't even think about that. Yeah, I forgot.
Yeah, what was it towing, involved, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so this whole mess is adrift now, and they had decided to launch... Is it the Point Turner out of Newport, because they weren't sure we were going to make it. So I didn't know this, but the Point Turner had got underway from Newport and then quickly diverted back to Point Judith because it was so rough. They lost their whole galley refrigeration and everything else. It broke free from the welds and basically was destroying the inside of the boat because it was this, you know, this giant reefer smashing around now. So when I got back in, it was like, what's that doing here? And then Castle Hill had sent their 44, and that guy was a surfman. And I get back in, they're like, "You got those guys?" And I was like, "Yeah, why?" And the kid from Castle Hill was like, "Wow, that's awesome, dude." He's like, "I can't believe you made that." And the I don't remember if it was a scene chief or a master chief from the Point Turner come over and kind of shook my hand. He said, "Good driving, boats. Good driving." And I didn't know why they were there at the time, but you know, I found all this out after the fact. But in the meantime, they were hatching a plan to try to figure out what to do with this thing. So they said, "Do you think you can get back out to it?" I said, "Yeah, I can go. I can get back out to it. Why?" "Oh, we're thinking about putting a couple of the crewmen back on it, on the barge, to try to anchor it." And I was like, "What? What are you talking about?
Are we taking volunteers for that one or what?"
Yeah. "You guys clearly don't understand what 30-foot seas mean."
Yeah, I said, do you realize how bad it is out there?" They're like, "Well, tell us what's going on." I said, "It's like zero viz. It's like Forrest Gump rain. It's raining up and sideways in every direction, and it's like zero viz. And it's like 30-foot seas." And at that point, it was up to 80-mile-an-hour winds. In fact, the chronometer at the station broke around 100 miles an hour, and it was stuck there. So it broke at 100 at the station.
That's pretty awesome. They let you take that thing home later. That's what you like keep on the wall.
This is what qualifies as a wicked nor'easter.
Oh, nice. Look at you.
It was a wicked nor'easter. So they're like, yeah, well, we got two guys that want to go back out and give it a try. And
who were these two guys? Were they the tug crew?
They were tug crew.
Yeah.
And the captain was like, the captain of the tug's like, I don't know if that's going to work, all this and that. And I had never seen the tug while we were out there. I'm sorry. I had never seen the barge while we were out there getting the guys off of it, off the tug. And I said, yeah, all right, we can give it a try. And I remember the master chief, I turned to the master chief and said, you're going to drive? And he was like, F no, I'll kill somebody. He goes, I'm not driving, you're driving. I was like, what? I just came back. They're like, do you want to do it or not? I said, all right, let's go. So, you know, you're young then. You're like, yeah, I'm invincible. I'll go. So we go back out. It was me, the master chief, and I don't know if he was an MK2 or an MK3, and he was from Trinidad. And he's a great guy and would do anything for you, and he's the kind of guy you'd do anything for. We start going, and then we had two tug crews. So we start going back out, and by now it's about 4 or 5 o'clock. It's getting dark, and we're going back out, and the MK, the whole, I don't fault the guy for this at all. I find it funny, but the whole time he was like white knuckles to the tow cage and would not let go. So we're cruising out. And it's me and the master chief, and he's like, oh, where do you think this thing's at? It's set pretty good. So the group's on the radio with us, and they're like, yeah, we don't know where it's at, but based on the star control is, you know, datum and all this and blah, 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 we think it's over here. And I'm like, nah, it's not over there. No way. It's over here.
I like it.
Every star. This is every star.
It just makes me smile.
Yep.
Yeah. So I'm like, that thing's not over there. No way. The wind's not going the right way. The waves are going this way. So I cruise to where I think it is, and sure enough, it's where I think it is.
Surprise, you know, surprise.
Yeah.
Zero shock on Phil's face or mine right now.
Yeah. So we get up there, and I could tell we were close because I could smell it, and I could see the orange glow in the fog. And I mean, this thing is just cooking now. Everything's on fire now. And I never did come across the tug again. But I found, because I was looking for the barge, I found the barge, and I pull up to this thing, and this thing's a loaded, you know, it's a loaded fuel barge. So it's got low freeboard on good weather. And I'm looking at this thing, and it's just like every third wave is a wash in the deck. And it was like, so we had a little conference, and me and the master chief and the MK and the two tug crewmen. And I mean, they got axes and flashlights and battle lanterns from the 44, and then, I mean, we loaded everything we could give them, bag of tools and whatever, so they could get this anchor free. And then we basically talked and said, can you guys do this? They're like, yeah, we'll give it a try. I'm like, all right, you realize the decks are awash and it's pretty rough. Oh yeah, and I give these guys credit for trying, but it was a futile mission to even try. So I pull up on the lee side of this barge, and I'm thinking, all right, I'm going to try to nose up to this thing, and we'll time it with the waves, and we'll get these guys off. And we pull up, and I successfully get them off, and it's like all of a sudden they get hit with a wave. It's like, oh, that guy's going over. And they, you know, there's tons of deck here, so they're like just grabbing on with all their might and holding on. And they make it to the anchor, and one of the crewmen was just, he was, you know, all he could do was just hang on. So he's just hanging on to the A-frame on the bow of this thing, and the other guy's whacking at the anchor, trying to get it the release to come free, and trying to get this thing to set and everything else. And I'm thinking, boy, how long have we been out here? So I'm looking, and I'm trying to figure it out, and by this point, I got nothing. Nothing's working. The only thing working is the radio and the fathometer. And I look back, and I'm like, what is that other boat doing out here? So on the radio, like, hey, boat with the white spotlight, stand off. There's a massive fire on the tug. I'm not sure where it's at in relation to us, whatever. So we go back, I'm watching, and I look, and that light is still there. I'm like, huh, that doesn't seem right. So I figured out, hey, that's a car on the beach.
So I call man, yeah.
I call the station. I'm like, hey, you got anybody on the beach? They're like, yeah, DEM, Department of Environmental Management, has got a truck on the beach. They see you. And I was like, uh-oh. So we had basically drifted across Nebraska Shoal. It was a shallow spot, and I think they think that's where it started to break. And I was like, we got to go. So we call these guys on the barge and say, hey, time's up. That's the beach behind us, you know, a couple hundred yards. So they're like, okay. We try to go back in. We try to go back in. And it was like, man, these things are worse. So the master chief's on the bow, and he's got the boat harness. At that time, it was just a waist belt with two clips. I think they probably still use the same thing.
Yeah, same. We call them heavy weather belts.
Yep.
Yeah, so he's got the heavy weather belt on, and he's in the nose inside the railings on the 44, getting ready to catch these guys as we, you know, as we try to pick them back up. So we pull in, and the one guy had made his way over to the side, and I just remember the wave being so big that I started to come across the crest of the wave, and I couldn't stop the boat from sliding down the wave. And I remember seeing the numbers, you know, the depth numbers, and it was like, oh, you know what? And you ever seen a dog run and hit the end of its leash without thinking about it?
Yep.
And it just goes, blast.
Man, what a great way to put that. That's exactly, yeah, I could totally see that. Yeah, that was good.
So the Master Chief's up there, and he's in his belt, and I can't stop the 44 from sliding down the wave. And, man, we T-boned that thing, and he went flying, and he got back. It took him a minute to get back up because he was, like, upside down and backwards. And he looks at me, and I point back, and I decided, you know what? I'm holding the boat here. So I'm pinned against the side of this barge, and we're, like, scratching all the way up because the wave's coming back up. And the one guy jumped, and then I kept trying, and I kept trying, and I kept trying, and now the light's like 50 yards away, and I looked at the master chief. I'm like, we got to go. He's like, what do you mean? I go, that's the beach right there. That's a truck on the beach. He's like, that's your call. I said, we got to go. I said, this is the worst decision of my life. We had to leave the guy there that was basically just clinging on to the A-frame structure of the anchor, because he basically would not let go, and we were out of time. So he's like, it's your decision. You got to make the call. I said, all right, we're leaving. I can't. I said, if we stay, we're all going to end up on the beach. So we called it in that we were leaving, and they had already, I don't know if they had already put up a helo from Cape Cod or not, but the helo came from Cape Cod, and I remember the kid, the pilot, because we, you know, we all get together and debrief, you know, weeks later. But the pilot was a cadet when I was at Cape Cod Canal, and he was now a pilot. And I remember him telling me, "Yeah, we hit this like solid wall of green on our flight radar or whatever it is," and he said we had to divert all the way to Providence, and we were considering landing and letting this thing ride by, but we were able to still be within, you know, maximum limits of the aircraft or something. So we took back off, flew north, and came around the back side of this thing. They ended up having to get the guy off the tug because he wasn't letting go for nothing. So they put a swimmer down or whatever and grabbed the guy with the, you know, with the helo. But we were on our way back. And I remember thinking, man, I got nothing. I got a radio at this point, and like nav lights that may or may not be working because it's, you know,
flickering.
Yeah, it's raining sideways, and it's, you know, everything's soaking wet in the cockpit of the 44. And I'm thinking, wow, I can't see nothing. I don't know where we are. So I start taking, you know, 1 minute runs at X number of intervals. And all of a sudden, I get two dots on the radar. And I look at the Master Chief and I say, that's the West Gap. He's like, ah, oh, I don't know. You want to put the anchor out and just wait it out? And I looked at him like, Master Chief, you want to pick up that 60-pound anchor? No, you're right. You're right. Let's not. And I said, that's the cut. That's the cut. That's where we're going. So I'm running. I'm just running a stopwatch and the radio. And I said, we're just going to go. And I just remember, you know, bosun mate math in my head running. And sure enough, we never saw the break wall. And we never saw the lights. So the two dots on the radar were the two lights that on each end of the break wall that we picked up. And all of a sudden we get through the cut and it was like someone flicked a switch and I could see the shore and I could see the wall and everything else. And I was like, huh, we're in. So we were right in the middle, kind of where I thought we were, because I had kind of pulled back the throttles and, you know, I told them, I said, I think we're inside. We're just going to, you know, I'm going to pull back and kind of station keep if I can and see where we're at. And sure enough, like I said, it was like a light switch. All of a sudden, I could see the channel entrance inside the break wall and the beach and the shoreline. I said, oh, awesome. And we went in and tied up. And I got word that the helo was on scene and they were trying to pick the guy up. And I was like, I remember being pissed because I couldn't get the guy. And then I remember being like, yeah, they got him. Awesome. So I was super excited once they got him. Cause I was like, you know, I didn't leave the watchroom until I knew they got him. And, once they got him, I went upstairs and I think I slept for like 2 days.
Deserved.
Yeah. I'm beat. And like I said, that, you know, we didn't have gloves and all that stuff. It was, my hands at that point were so, because I had never let go of the throttles the whole time I was on the 44. My hands were like cramped and it was like, ugh. And I was so beat, I went and slept for like 2 days and then, you know, dealt with everything afterwards. So it was certainly a highlight of my career. And I think back to when I was at Cape Cod Canal, when I had a chief that wouldn't let me qualify as a non-rate as a coxswain. And I think, yeah, I proved you wrong.
That's good.
Yeah, did you call him afterwards?
No, I'd lost touch with him long ago. But in the aftermath, the chief on the point turner was, you know, he's like, I can't believe you did that. That was some great driving. And I remember the kid from Castle Hill on his 44, he was a surfman. You know, surfman school graduate, and he was like, I don't want to call him afraid or a chicken or anything, because he was a surfman. He was, you know, surfman top notch. But I could tell from him that, you know, he was like, man, how did you do that? And because it was so rough, and both of those assets, you know, had turned to port when I was out there with the 44, you know, and I'm just like, yeah, we can do this, and just keep trudging along. But a lot of that comes from the faith that you're taught to have in the platform, you know, the thing. And, you know, the drippy Detroits, you know, they'll run and run and run. And I'll tell you what, those engines did everything I asked of them. And I'll tell you what, I mean, you know, I wouldn't call them crash starts, but going down the face of some of those waves and trying to, you know, position keep to get those guys back off was full ahead to full reverse. And you know, and then we pinned the side of that boat. The boat never got a leak. It maintained structural integrity. But I had, you know, I had curled, I don't know if you're familiar with the 44s, they have the bullnose right on the bow. I had basically curled the bullnose around underneath itself. But
it takes some force.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they did a pressure test and everything, and the boat held structural integrity and watertight. So
Yeah, that's a good point too, man. Like, having faith in the boat definitely gives you faith in yourself and the crew.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
100%, right?
Yeah, yep. And it, you know, it takes all the crew in the background to make sure that thing's working.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And ready to go for that situation. But go ahead.
I'm curious. I assume that barge did end up on the beach after they got everybody off, though.
Yeah, so everything ended up on the beach. They think the tug actually rolled over at some point because the fire was out when it ended up on the beach. And I think it was 4 million gallons of number 2 home heating oil had leaked out and had gone into the water. And, you know, I don't want to be mean, but you get all the tree huggers out there and they're like, oh my God, oh my God. A catastrophe. Well, I mean, if you whip the seas up to 30 feet and, you know, 80 mile an hour winds and, you know, you go back to the beach the next day, you're going to see lobsters and crabs and, you know, all kinds of debris on the beach, regardless of whether there's oil there or not. But it all ended up on the beach, and I remember it was a long process to actually get the thing off the beach. They brought this massive, massive crane barge unit. I want to say it came from Norfolk or New York. I remember it was really far away. That's why I think it was Norfolk. And I want to say they had trouble even moving it and getting it to go. So in the process, you know, when the weather calmed down, they had lightered the barge to get all the, you know, all the oil off of it and everything. And it was just, it was still stuck there. And I want to say the whole thing took like 6 months to finally get everything off the beach.
I can believe it. That's a huge process.
They were waiting on tides and weather, and they were waiting on, you know, the right conditions. And then, you know, they're trying to lift the tug out, and the tug, it's too heavy, and it's, you know, then they bring in, you know, excavators and dig out around it, try to, I think it's called suction or whatever, where it gets stuck. So they finally get that thing off and get that out, and then they finally get the, you know, the barge out of the sand, and, you know, the thing had basically shoulder beach up around it in the meantime.
And how often had you been training, Mike, like out there on the 44? Like, I mean, how long had you been at Station Point Judith when this happened?
I think I got to Point Judith in 92. So I had been a 44 coxswain for, I don't know, probably 4 or 5 years by now.
Yeah.
At least. But
did you guys train in heavy weather a lot?
We would try, and we would go out. And the point, you know, I think, I don't remember who, I think it was Phil that said the surfers on the beach there, the surfers used to go out front. So we would go out, and they'd get mad at us because we'd go out in front of the station and up the beach and practice in the heavy weather and all that. So we, you know, we did do some training, but at Point Judith, we weren't a surf station.
Yeah.
So, you know, we weren't allowed to, quote, be in the surf. But, you know, we tried to take advantage of it whenever we could.
Yeah. Paid dividends that day, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. So it definitely did. And, you know, everything worked like it was supposed to, which was great. So, you know, the crew was all there. And you know, the second crew that I went out with was a whole new crew because the first crew basically said, I'm not going back out. So...
What about the MK? Did he volunteer to go? The one that was white knuckle on the back?
He volunteered to go on the second run.
Yeah.
And I think he, I don't want to say he regretted it, but I think he was like, kind of like, wow, this is really, really, really bad.
Yeah. I've had that happen before with people that get seasick, but they're like real motivated to go. And then 2 seconds away from the dock, like you're puking.
Right.
And you're just wondering like, man, I knew better. Right?
Why did I bring you?
Yeah. I knew better.
Yeah. And that's what happened on the first crew. You know, I went out with a 5-man crew because when we went back with the 41, I was like, yeah, I need a few more people too. When we decided to take the 44.
Right.
But, you know, when we got back with those, I think 3 of them were puking themselves. So, you know, I was like, yeah, they weren't going to go anyway. And then, of course, the swimmer was hypothermic. So it was like, all right, I need a new volunteer crew.
Yeah.
And that's what it was. I remember them saying, who wants to volunteer for this? And it was the same thing with the tug crew. Does anybody want to volunteer to try this? And the captain was like, the tug captain was like, I don't know about that. And then the two guys said, we'll do it. We'll try it.
I give those guys a lot of credit too.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I mean, like, was there a bonus involved or something? Like, yeah. I mean, that's it's pretty.
Yeah. In the old hindsight 2020 thing, it was a futile effort, and you know you can second guess yourself all day long. But knowing now what I know after the fact, the anchor had, you know, it hadn't been exercised in a while, and basically needed a blowtorch to get it loose. You know, obviously I didn't know that before I went out, but in hindsight, looking at it, you know, yeah, is that much fuel an environmental catastrophe? Certainly. But is it, you know, is it worth the risk of life to try it again? Depends on who you talk to.
Yeah, so that's fair.
I've never come to my own conclusion whether I would do that again or not, trying to put people back on, because you can see both sides of it. And, you know, I like the earth and I like the water and I don't want it to be contaminated, but the risk was certainly there for a loss of life.
Right. Well, you made the choice based on the info you had at the time. Like you said, if you had known they didn't know what preventative maintenance was on the anchor, maybe you would have made a different choice then, but you didn't know that till after the fact, so.
Or if you'd asked them, like, hey, why are you guys bringing all those axes and everything? Right. Like, what's wrong with this? You know, that's what I was kind of wondering when you were like, yeah, they're bringing all this gear and all everything. I'm like, what were they trying to do?
I just take for granted that none of those commercial boats ever use any of that stuff.
I just thought they were trying to make it dramatic. You know what I mean? Like, I want to chop this thing and, you know, just make it look cool.
Yeah, well, I mean, we all kind of game planned before we left and said, what do you need? And they were like, yeah, let's have this and that and, you know, and radios and anything we can take, basically. I mean,
yeah, Semper Paratus. I get it.
How much of that stuff just ended up in the drink when you put them right. over, too? Like,
I don't think we recovered anything except for their radio, and obviously the two guys. But
right. Well,
and
that's what really mattered, right?
Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
I like that nav back in on the inbound run, man. Because that's kind of a scary feeling when you're out there and you lose it, right?
Right.
Like you lose the ball and you're like, man, I think I know where I am, but I'm not sure.
Well, yeah. Phil's going to make fun of me. This is going to sound lame, but all I can think of, like you mentioned Mike being stationed at Chatham, right?
Yeah.
The comparison to Bernie Weber.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen the Disney movie, right?
Yeah.
Don't know how accurate it is, but where they, like, they're coming back in from saving all those people in that boat, and all of a sudden, like, they don't even realize it, but they're, like, back across the bar and in the harbor because it was, you know, dark, stormy.
Yeah,
that's kind of what this reminded me of, where, like, you found those two dots, and you're like, oh, we're in. Cool. That's
yeah, cool. I mean, it's Seaman's Eye and you know, it's AOR fam. I mean, you got to know where your area is and, you know, DR and all that. You got to – I used to drive people nuts because I would never pick out a chart. And we won't tell anybody listening that, but I hated having a chart out and I hated, you know, navving on a chart while you're in a small boat. I mean – to me, that always seemed like the most ridiculous thing, but what was more important to me is taking your chart and going out and visually identifying everything so that you know, hey, this is where I am, and this is what it looks like on a radar picture, and, you know, if I lose viz, I know my radar picture to match my chart, and that, you know, that's what I call Seaman's Eye you know, area fam. You got to know your area, where you're at.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes it scary, right, is when somebody like you, right, that I know just from hearing you describe the area, I know that you know the whole area, right? So if you lose it, like,
right.
It must be bad out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's what I was getting at.
Yeah, yep, definitely. It was the worst conditions I've ever been in my entire Coast Guard career.
Yeah.
You know, all the news called it the winter hurricane and, you know, the perfect storm and all that stuff, like, you know, because that's essentially what it was. And, you know, 30-foot seas, 80-mile-an-hour winds, and, you know, I don't care what boat you're on, you're going to lose some of your electronics. So you got to know what's going on.
Yeah, and that's, you know, what I kept thinking, Bill brought up, like, the Finest Hours movie. I kept thinking about, you kept saying, like, the only thing we had left was, like, our radio and our pathometer. And I was like, man, Bernie Weber just killed that radio about 3 seconds outside the break wall.
Yeah. I was surprised because, you know, everything on a 44 is always wet. And you know, it worked. The radio worked. And I should take that back. I still have my compass, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because you had an actual compass and not some heading sensor that probably just broke off its mount.
Yep.
Yeah.
An old school compass that worked. So
for all you young people listening out there, that's why we still make you learn how to do that stuff. Because sometimes the video game doesn't work.
It's true.
That is.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
It's true.
Well, Mike, take us back to your first SAR case ever, like back at Station Cape Cod Canal.
So my as a coxswain or as a non-rater? Or
either one. Like, what was your intro to the CG?
So my intro to the CG was my dad saying, no, you're not going to the Navy like I did.
Right, smart man.
You're going to go in the Coast Guard. In fairness, my dad was Navy aviation too. So, and you know, at the time he was Secret Squirrel. He did a bunch of stuff in Vietnam. That's a whole nother side story. But all of his missions didn't get declassified until about 15 years ago because he was flying behind enemy lines. But sideways.
What did he fly?
P2VEs. It's a 2-prop, 2-jet kind of plane, and they were the last unit to use the Norden bomb sight from World War II.
Oh, like the one that people still had to look through, right? To do the math.
So one line moved and the other line,
So they were basically flying treetop missions in Vietnam, dropping listening devices behind enemy lines to track troop movements.
Very cool.
And that's cool, man.
Yeah, they lost a crew, and you know, they had some issues, but most of them came back anyway. So he told me, no, you're not going to the Navy, why don't you look at the Coast Guard? And I said, what is that? So he took me to the local recruiter, and I was like, you know, watching the videos of boats on fire and babies in the surf or whatever you want to call it, and I was like, wow, that looks cool. I want to help people. That's you know, I like that. That's a meaningful job. So we went down the recruiter, and anyway, I did that and joined the Coast Guard. But my first SAR case as a coxswain, as an upright coxswain, was on the 41-footer at Cape Cod Canal. And again, it was pretty rough for Cape Cod Bay. It was blowing probably 30, and it was probably 10-foot seas. We were probably at the limits of the 41. And I was all excited. I'm like, oh, I get my first case. Yes. Awesome. I get to drive the boat without the training wheels. So I was running down the dock to get on the boat, and there's the ops, the BM1. He's a great guy. And he's like, oh, I'm going to go with you. And I was like, man.
Yeah, right. Stay at the dock.
Yeah. I was like, man. So I'm like, all right, come on, let's go. So we go out there, and it was like a 70-foot, like, catamaran thing. And it was like this thing from Waterworld or something. It was just bizarre. So I'm kind of glad he did go, because I got out there, and in true sailboat form, they couldn't do anything right. They kept trying to catch the ball and pull the line in. So they finally got connected with the tow. We tow them in, and I'm outside the east entrance of the Cape Cod Canal. And I'm like, all right, let's get this thing inside tow and you know, get it on the hip and get it in. So we get it on, and we, you know, I'm way back on this thing, and I've got maybe half the 41 on the stern end of this thing. And I'm having a real hard time, because the current gets whipping in the canal. I'm having a real hard time with the current and the wind controlling this thing and keeping it down the canal. So I ended up having to drive past the entrance to the station because I just couldn't control it. And the BM1 jumped on the ops, and he's like, oh, let me give it a try. I'm like, all right. I said, am I doing something wrong? He's like, no, you're doing everything the way you're supposed to. So he gets on, and he's got the throttles full split, and this cavitation, and it's like, woo! And I'm thinking, wow, that's a lot. And he spun around a couple of times just trying to control it. And we're like, all right, well, what are we going to do? I said, honestly, I think we should put this thing in like a T, like a tug and a notch. So we're kind of looking at it. I was like, no, that's not going to work because the spreaders are going to break or something stupid. So we just kept it on. And I want to say we ended up going in backwards because that was surprisingly the only way we had control of this thing was to drift past the inlet and then just full power this thing astern. And, you know, we basically crabbed in, we paralleled the inlet and basically crabbed into the harbor. And once we got in out of the current, we were able to control it a lot more. And he gave it back to me and said, yeah, put it to the dock. So I remember having to use a lot of throttle and thinking, wow, that was a lot. I mean, you know, a brand new Seaman toxin driving a 41, having to use full power, you know, on some decent weather, you know, 30 knot winds and you know, 10, 12 foot waves. It was like, okay.
Yeah. I love it when a plan doesn't come together like that. Right. And then you're just like, man, what do I do now?
Yeah. That can be a nasty spot right there. By the station. Cape Cod Canal.
And it was, you know, it was nothing in the textbook is working.
Right.
So what do? So we just kind of said, all right, well, let's try this. And you know, it was like, all right, well, this seems to work, so let's just go with it.
Yeah, like so, you say, you kind of got to watch. You just watch it for a minute, right? Like, which way are we going? How am I, you know, where do I got to apply power and where do I not? I like it.
Yeah. So I remember in my training, speed kills. And I was like, yeah, okay. And you know, I remember kind of along the lines of speed kills, if it doesn't work, step back, take a look at it, and figure it out.
And you found out what, like, RPM doesn't equate speed sometimes, right?
Yeah.
You know?
No, definitely not. Yeah. Definitely. So it was interesting, that's for sure, for a first case. So,
yeah. Well, take us to the station Chatham. I know you guys were on some of those nearshore lifeboats. Those, you know, are a little unique to the service because of the water depth out there, right?
Yeah, so I left Point Judith for another station, and I call it Surf Station Chatham. And I'm probably the biggest pro surfman that never was because, you know, it's a crucial program in my opinion. And I remember thinking, wow, I'm going to Chatham. Cool. They're a surf station. Maybe I'll work on surfmen. And then, you know, I got there. It was a really cool station. And I actually met Bernie Weber. We had a reunion. I have a picture somewhere. We had the whole crew in for a luncheon reunion kind of thing. And I've got a book signed by Bernie and all the crew and a nice station photo with them. But it was a cool station. It was like nothing I'd ever seen before because we were running all non-standard, whatever we could get our hands on, jet drives and things like that, and it was a lot of shallow water.
What did you think of driving jet drives after driving props for so long?
If you know what you're doing with a jet drive, it's the most maneuverable boat you'll ever drive.
Yeah, that's what I'd agree with you, yeah.
The key is if you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's my opinion. But
how do they have bucket controls on those things, or what do the controls look like on a?
Yeah, so it's a bucket.
Yeah.
one thing I think a lot of people had a hard time with was dual shifters on a single engine, because you have your throttle and then you have your button.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people would try to run the throttle in the direction at the same time, which is what the 41s and 44s were. But, you know, you get on something with, oh, I got to run the RPM up and then I got to shift the bucket to reverse or forward, or what I call neutral or hover. Because you can run the RPMs way up and just sit there and not go anywhere.
Hover, man. But, I like it. Hover. Hover, yeah, we're always looking for an answer to it, because we, like you just said, you kind of think of it as neutral, right? Even though you're neutral throttle or neutral bucket, but you're not really, like, the RPMs are still
you're
raging.
Never really in neutral, yeah.
Yeah.
Hover. I like it.
Yeah.
So it was a cool station. We had two 44s and these 28-foot LeComps when I first got there, and they were cool because they were a full tube all the way around the transom and everything. They were full tube rib, so there was a bumper everywhere, which was kind of cool. And they had this little doghouse on them, but they were fiberglass and they were getting kind of old. And we had boats on Stage Harbor and on the Chatham side. So again, the typical New England station, like you said, we were split from the station. We had to drive to two different locations depending on whether it was in the sound or on the ocean. So we were running 28s, and that was my first experience with a Coast Guard jet. And they were a surf station working on a surf station, recertifications and everything. And apparently what had happened just before I got there was the Cape D had come out for their stant or whatever. And I guess they took the stant team out, and Chatham is unfortunately a touch bottom frequently station. And they said they took the stand team out, they touched bottom a few times and then laid over one time on the sand, and the Cape D guys went back, said, okay, we're done here, got on the plane and left, because they scared the crap out of them.
That's good.
Yeah. So after the 28s were
what was the depth? What was the depth going out of the harbor?
When you leave the docks, it's like 10 feet, but when you get out there, because it's all beach sand, and it's basically the tip of the elbow of Cape Cod, it would always change. And the harbor master out there was excellent with, you know, you weren't running buoys, you were running lobster pots, because that's what the harbor master put out.
Yeah.
That's what he could service, you know, with two guys on a boat.
That's awesome. Bill just cried a little bit.
So, you know, you're running basically this lobster pot high flyer for your aids to nav. And again, you're in a surf zone. Basically, you know, once you come around the channel to start heading out, you better be prepared, because you're potentially going to get some surf. And, you know, until you got outside, you had the potential to surf. And it was an ever-changing situation. In fact, I was on the 28 one time, and we were way up inside the channel, and I had run the 28 up earlier that day, and then we were running it out to go do a case or something. And I had run the channel on the way up, and sure enough, I'm running the channel on the way back, and I'm going by the buoy, and I got my head out the window because it's night and it's got all that mist, and I can't see out the damn window. All of a sudden, I go by the buoy, boom, run that thing around, and I'm like, I smashed my eye on the window. Oh. I broke my eye socket. I get out of the doghouse and I look, and one of the crewmen's already on the sandbar. He's like, yeah, we're not going anywhere. I look over and the whole boat just kind of leans over and falls over. And I was like, what the hell? And like I said, we had just run that channel earlier that day. So we were stuck there and my eye swelled shut, and I remember the warrant saying you need help, and I'm like, nah, I'll be fine, and I smashed my eye. And but that's you know, that's to point out the level of how often that the sand changed there.
Yeah.
And that wasn't even on the inlet. But I remember another time running the 44, and we had what we called the south cut, and you had to run the beach and then turn in to the southern end of the inlet. Well, I was running the beach, and all of a sudden, somebody yells out, "High side, break!" And I look, and it was like, "Oh crap!" And I think the kid on the low side was underwater, and the kid on the high side was like hanging from a rope, so to speak. And I felt the boat kind of bump, bump, bump while it was on its side, and we rolled flat, and it was like, "Oh, we're not going anywhere." Crap. And as soon as the wave came in again, it was like, "Punch it." And we just punched it. And like,
as soon as the water goes under, we're good.
Yeah, as soon as we had water underneath it, it was like, "Punch it." And we just, boop, and we got back in. But that was the difficulty of Chatham, was the ever-changing conditions.
Did you ever get a shark attack out there? Because that's Jaws territory, right? Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of sharks out there because the Monomoy Island is loaded with seals. One case we had, we were in the 14-foot whaler, and we were trying to find somebody on Monomoy Island, and it's notorious for fog. So we're like, "All right, let's beach the boat and go look for these people, try to find them." So we're walking the island. All of a sudden, these seals start chasing us. Like, this crazy run back to the boat to try to get in the boat and get away from these damn seals. And we got back in the whaler, and we're like, "All right, let's try something else." We're cruising around, literally like something you'd see from a fishing show in the flats with like no water under you. But anyway, we eventually ended up getting this near shore lifeboat, and I had gone to it was either leadership and management or XPO course at the academy. And we had to give this little bio of where we were currently at. And everyone was like, "Oh, what is that boat?" And it was like, "Oh, it's a great boat, blah, blah, blah." And I'm biting my tongue thinking, "Man, this thing is a piece of garbage."
Right. There's always one voice of reason.
Yeah. But it was well-intended what they were trying to do because, you know, we couldn't run 47s. In Chatham because we'd wipe the running gear out every time we went in or out. So the 44s had the full keels and were much better suited. So so they came up with this jet drive twin engine British boat. It was made by Hallmark. And like I said, it was well intentioned what it was supposed to do. But, you know, I think what the British tend to do is they use something and then throw it away. As opposed to us with keeping it for 500 years and you know, hand me down some other service. But we ran that boat for a while, and we kept ripping the foam-filled sponson off, and we had traction issues. The non-skid stick-ons kept coming off. So we tried to line-X the thing like a bed liner, and that eventually failed. And I think we took one or two windshields out. I don't remember now.
You sure it wasn't made by Metal Shark?
Yeah,
you're never gonna jump for Metal Shark, Phil.
I know, I can't help it.
I luckily didn't have the pleasure of having to run one of those, but I hear a lot of horror stories from friends that are still in and driving.
If you watch CG memes, and I mean, there's a reason there's a meme for it like twice a day.
yeah. So, the other problem with the boat was that you literally couldn't work on it. The engines were so compacted in there that you could get your hand between the two engines, and that was it.
Right.
So if you had to do anything, you had to pull the motor. But what kind of idiotic idea was that? So the biggest problem for me with the boat was you sat all the way in the front of the damn boat. And I mean, if you think about it, what's the most active part of the boat?
Oh yeah. Wow. For sure.
That thing's going up and down. Who designed the seat? The coxswain seat to be at the front windshield, right at, you know, the first 10 feet of the boat. So it sucked to me. I hated the boat. And then we got the 25s. And we were running those, but we couldn't run them in the surf. And I ended up leaving before they came up with their new, they have a new 40 something. It's not the, I think they have the 45s that you guys are running now, but they have a different 45 or 42 or something that's surf rated.
Yeah. So, I think Safe Boats 25 could have handled it. I think so.
I I do too. I remember going out one time.
A couple mishap messages that would probably disagree.
I have never had a problem in that boat in like the worst seas that.
I've never had a problem in a Tanby, and now we're not allowed to take them out above 3 feet either.
The Tanby.
I've been out in 7 feet in that.
The Tanby wasn't designed for, but safe boat designs there for you know hard living. I think. Yeah.
Yeah, the safe boats were fast, so you could always run.
Did you ever drive a 33? You were ever like stepped foot on one?
No, I never drove a 33, but I did drive a 30. I was qualified on a 30.
Yeah.
SRB or whatever they called it, the surf boat, and that was fun. Nobody, I'm gonna
the egg, back, right? They call it the egg.
The egg or the sneaker?
Yeah, the sneaker. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna back up to my Point Judith days. We used to send that boat out to Block Island because we ran the summer season station at Block Island, and I to the life of me can't figure out why people didn't want to go to that for their duty, for their 2 days of duty, because you're on basically a vacation island, and you know you carried a beeper and a phone until you were needed. I mean, you did some maintenance on the boat or whatever, but we used to send the 30 out there all the time. And that I liked that boat. It was fun. I think why a lot of people didn't like it was because it was a single screw, and it was powerful. I mean, that boat ripped. It would, you know, it would do 28 knots or something.
Yeah, a little harder to drive though, huh?
And I think that's why a lot of people didn't like it, because a lot of people, you know, didn't understand single screw, and that, you know, when you drive a single screw, you got to overcompensate when you're going to back.
Yeah, and like the 10th time that you get your butt handed to you while you're trying to moor it and people are watching, like people lose interest right. Pretty quick, you know? That's what I've seen.
This boat over here is easy to drive.
Yeah, I like this boat where I can split throttle.
Yes. And you know, all you got to do is start far enough out, and it's going to prop walk like crazy for the first 20 feet. But then once you get water going over that rudder, I called it the barn door. I mean, it had a good sized rudder on it. And once you got water going over that rudder, you could just back and fill and, you know, walk yourself right into the dock. So,
what did that thing draft?
It wasn't much.
Yeah. How many people were on it? What minimum crew, like two?
Yeah, we used to run two men at Block Island.
Yeah, that's cool. I think you're the first like 30-foot, or maybe the second 30 SRB guy on the show.
I've never heard of it before today.
Oh, I'll show you a picture, man. Yeah. This thing's wild looking. Yeah, it does not look like a boat.
Right.
It's funky looking and
looks like a life car, right? Like you remember those old life cars that they used to like go back and forth on the breeches buoy or whatever. That's what it looks like.
Okay.
Or that same line that they would shoot.
For the life of me, I can't figure out why they sent one to be a lawn ornament at Camp Lejeune.
Is there one there?
There was. At one point, they had one for a lawn ornament, and I was like, wait a minute, this is the tactical boat coxswain school. Why is there a 30-foot surf boat here?
That's funny.
Because they needed something.
Yeah, we needed something, right? The Marines have tanks, so we're going to get this guy. That's good.
Yep. So we were prone to 44s at Chatham, and we went through quite a few of them, because as they were decomming 44s, they would do surveys and comparisons and say, oh, this one's better than this one that you have now. And I want to say when I was at Chatham, we ended up with like six different ones, and we ultimately ended up with the 301 from the school at Chatham. And I went back to... after I was retired, I went back to Chatham when they did the lawn ornament dedication ceremony. They put it on the front yard at Chatham.
Is that the same one you drove?
Yeah.
Very cool.
It's cool that you drive something that's now like a museum piece or an ornament, but at the same time, you're like, man, I'm getting old. I used to drive that thing.
Right?
That's good.
So. But Chatham, I ended up going to surf school when I was at Chatham, and I kind of had a chip on my shoulder about, like I said, I'm like probably the biggest pro surfman that never was, and I went to surf school, and I was young still, and I had a chip on my shoulder. I ended up having to change instructors because I didn't agree with the instructor and. You know, all this and that, and I ended up not even graduating surfman school because we lost weather, and they're like, oh, do you want to stay for the 47? And I looked at the guy, and I was like, well, you almost killed me on my surf swim on the first day of school, which I find funny that you had chili dogs for lunch, and then you stick us all in the water for our swim. Like, that's a guaranteed recipe to puke. And then...
you got to make it interesting.
Yeah, so I jumped in the water. I'm like, save yourself, save yourself. I jumped off the 44 for the surf swim. But I ended up not graduating. I respectfully declined to stay the other week for the 47 to learn the 47. And it, you know, that was fine because I never ended up being on a 47 as a duty station or anything.
I get it, though. It just kind of stinks you were in the right area on the right platforms and with the right weather for the most part. But,
yeah,
like, the policy-wise just never allowed it to be right. A surf station while you were there. I get it.
Well, we were a surf station, but we had, you know, our certs had run out. And we were
still trying to turn it back on, right?
Yeah, yeah, and they are a surf station now, which is great.
Yeah.
It was largely in part to the warrant that was there, and then a bunch of us that were, you know, we were adamant about keeping the cert quals and or keeping the certifications up to keep that station certified.
You're just old guard, Mike. That's what it is. You're old guard, you know?
I believe that. Yeah. I believe that.
I mean, there's a 30-foot SRB sitting in front of Station Chatham now as a testament to that. So you can claim it.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, hey, Mike, I'll ask you. Let's ask you one more. What? I know that you served as XPO for two tours?
Yeah. So I went to the Grand Isle, which was actually the Block Island, because the Grand Isle went overseas. I was ops there, and then from there, that was a fiasco. That was a whole ship swap thing, and I think based on the Grand Isle Block Island swap, Coast Guard deemed that that wasn't a good idea to do that anymore. So anyway, I went to I got ops, and I got I had gone to XPO school or whatever, and I got short toured out of the 110 because the XPO on the Chinook was a QMBM and had never been in
a leadership role in his life.
Yeah, I mean, they set the poor guy up for failure.
Yeah.
And this is nothing against the guy, because, you know, he had never done anything like that. He was a chart paper guy. You know, he's a navigator. So he the unit had lost, they had even lost control of their budget. They didn't even have control of their budget. They, if they wanted anything, they had to call the sector, and if they, you know, they basically couldn't even get underway,
which is funny because that's kind of the way it is now, right? Like, he would have fit in well.
You now know, that's just the system.
Yeah, that model would have worked these days.
What do you mean?
They
not having any control over your budget.
What's the call? What's the whole thing called?
I forget what it's called.
It's like
now.
I have no idea what they call it, but yeah, that's basically what it is. Like a system where your yeoman and your SKs and everybody else is off site.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I got there kind of off tour season, and I remember, and I'm going to throw this out there real quick so I don't forget. As far as jobs-wise, that was actually the best job I ever had. So I got there, and I got the MK chief, and I got the lieutenant junior grade, and I met with both of them, and then I sat in the office with the CO, and she basically said, she said, I don't care what you do, keep me out of trouble, and get us operational. Because at that time, they had basically, the CO was the only DWO, and the chief was the only underway EOW. And I, you know, from that meeting, I discovered we didn't even have control of our budget. I said, okay, first thing we got to do is I got to do an inventory. I got to meet the rest of the crew, got to find out what's going on here. So for the first week, I kind of met everybody and went through our inventory and our training program, which was essentially non-existent for everything. And I met with the RNS guy, who was BM3 or BM2. I think he had just made BM2. And he was like, look, I have nothing to give you. I was like, what do you mean? He said, we don't have anything. So I walked through the inventory, and sure enough, I mean, it was horrendous.
Yeah, that's an issue.
So I said to the CEO, I said, we need to go down the sector, and I need to meet with the staff down there, because unless I get our budget back and I get some help from outside, from the GMs and the yeomen and the storekeepers and from the sector captain, we're facing a long uphill battle. She said, okay. So her and I got in the truck and we drove down to New Haven and met the captain. And the first guy we met was the warrant for the storekeepers. And I said, I need credit cards. He said, I'm not giving you your budget. I said, I need my budget. And on top of that, I need another budget because we have nothing. And I had basically typed up a spreadsheet of what we had. I said, here's why we can't get underway. Here's what we don't have. And here's what I'm going to need after you give me this.
The slow death of a BM is what this is, right? Like, you get to go from all the cool guy driving the boats in the surf to spreadsheets.
Right.
No, but it's a necessary evil, right?
And it's a leadership position, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm guessing you learned some leadership lessons out of a job, probably that job, and I think you did another XPO tour there. So, you know, what'd you learn from it? I guess that's the real question. What kind of leadership lessons you take out of those command tours you had?
So the captain, I'm going to stop you for a second. So the captain looked at the warrant and said, give him a budget. So we got the budget, and he said, I'm going to do weekly inspections. I said, how about monthly? And he came out for his first month inspection with the captain of the sector. We had a little luncheon, and I showed him my books, and they were down to the penny. And he said, I can't even get storekeepers to get down to the penny. I said, I assume we're all good here then?
Yeah, nice.
He said, yep, no problem. So anyway, the takeaway from command roles, and I'm like Captain Kirk. I didn't want to do anything but drive boats, you know? Like, he didn't want to do anything except for drive ships or spaceships, you know?
So I think the right term is starships.
I think starships. We all want to drive spaceships, but...
There is a space force now, know, so, right? Like, now you got to start watching that stuff, because you never know, right?
So it was interesting. I took the job, and I said, you know what? I've got people here counting on me. I've got command structure looking to me to fix the problems. I need to make this right, and I need to take care of these people, because I could tell, you know, some of the junior people had been there for a few months or even a year, and I could tell just by meeting them that, you know, they were cooked. They were depressed, like, oh my God, we're the worst unit in the district and we can't even get underway. And I remember my BM1s from Cape Cod Canal, who were a couple of great guys, but the XPO Cape Cod Canal was, I mean, he's the guy that really, like, looked out for me. He's the guy that gave me, you know, pushback against that chief there that say, you know, because I had a 2-day coxswain board, which is unheard of now, I guess, but he pushed back, and I remember his leadership style was give the people a job, let them do it, give them instruction if they ask, and give them an opportunity to prove themselves. So I think that what was really cool was that being the first XPO job, I was allowed to basically have full run, and it was great to work with the CO and the chief together to go for a directive to get this thing going. And you've got to take care of your people in your command, because I'm trying to think of what I used to say. From ordinary people come extraordinary things, is what I used to say. And, you know, who wants that BM standing over them? You're not painting that right. You're not doing that right. Yeah. Nobody does. So you got to let people go. And I remember the CO on the Chinook, she was mad because we were painting the hull out on a patrol break, and she said, they're not doing that right. I said, I know. She said, well, aren't you going to fix that? I said, nope. She got mad. She's like, why aren't you going to fix that? They're wasting time, and we're going to have to do it again. I said, you know what, ma'am? No matter what I tell them, some things are best learned from firsthand experience.
Yeah. Perfect. That's, what a good that is a good one.
There's the lesson right there. Yeah, right learning there. From firsthand. Yeah, because they're going to learn a lot more when they do it again. So, yeah.
And that's what it was. That's what it came down to. Yeah. And the paint ended up bubbling and blistering. And I basically said to him, I said, okay, you didn't want to listen to me the first time. Guess what? We're going to do it again.
There you go.
So, I love it.
Well, hey, Mike, we sure appreciate all the stories. And
we want to have you back on,
yeah,
too,
for
Mike.
Sure. Yeah, I think we got more to talk about.
We're getting pressed for time on this one. But,
okay.
Hey, we had what a blast, man.
Yeah,
and
I enjoyed it a lot.
As many times as you – or as many years as you did at at stations, 110s and 87, like, I think we've just brushed the surface of some of the stories that you could tell us. So we'd love to have you back on if you're willing.
Oh, yeah, anytime. I got all kinds of stories from every unit.
Solid, awesome. Man. Well, hey, I know now you're running your own landscaping company, M&L Landscaping, out in Warwick, Rhode Island, right?
Yes, that's right. So when I retired, I was kind of burnt out and decided I didn't want to work for anybody for a while. And I started my own construction and landscaping company. And construction's tough in Rhode Island because everybody that's got a hammer wants to do it. Same thing with landscaping. But I close the construction side and I just do small landscape, and I got some really nice deals. I've got some. I actually cut the grass at Castle Hill.
Love it.
Where I retired from, and I cut the grass for the Federal Aviation Administration over at TF Green Airport, and a couple other small gum. Too far into depth, but I ran for state rep twice, and then I was nominated to be one of the chairs of the Warwick Republican City Committee. So I have no idea what I'm doing, but
when you reach the highest levels, just remember who got you where you are and make sure they're properly funded, right?
yeah I think the folks are just kind of looking to me for some of my past leadership experience to kind of help them get reorganized and get moving again.
Well, we'll put up links, Mike, to the to M&L Landscaping. I know you guys can be found on Facebook, and if you guys are in the Warwick area or know of any business, you can steer that way. I think we got a one for you.
And, all right.
Again, man, love to have you back on sometime. We really appreciate your time, and we thank you for your 23 years of service.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Take care.
All right, you too.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you liked what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.